This podcast is part of the Gunna Geek Network. The opinions expressed may not reflect those of other podcasts or affiliates of this show or Gunna Geek. Check out other geeky podcasts at gunnageek.com. Get ready because geekiness commences in 3, 2, 1.
Welcome to Gallifrey Public Radio, a podcast dedicated to everything Doctor Who. Join us each week for discussions ranging from Hartnell to Capaldi. I'm your host, Jay Whitten.
I prefer to jazzercise my demons, but yeah.
And Keir Hansen.
Gallifrey Public Radio, now we have maths.
Spoilers.
We will be discussing news and rumors, as well as episodes that have already aired. But if we get anything too serious, don't worry. We'll warn you again.
Welcome to episode 87 of Gallifrey Public Radio, where tonight we take the first steps toward the complete revitalization of an idea that went away for years and then came back for 90 minutes, was carried on by fans in a lot of unsanctioned work, and all but faded into obscurity, but with thanks to a blonde pop star, an unabashed northern accent, and a fair pinch of regional color, we find just the magic wand we were looking for. Here in the GPR studios tonight, my name is Keir. Joining me, as always, is my my time twin, Jay. How are you tonight, sir?
I'm doing great. How about yourself?
All right, as always. Haley is also with us in the studio tonight. Haley, how are you, dear?
I'm doing all right.
Rocking on. And joining us is our one of our longtime listeners, occasional guests, and good friend. You know him as Soleil. We know him as Bert. Good evening, sir.
Either way is fine.
Okay. That's all right. He's very flexible. He goes.
Just like gymnastics.
51st century guy.
Exactly.
Just a little more flexible. Well, tonight we are making the leap across the time divide from what we, and yes, we're sorry to those few folks who have called us out on it, we have to refer to as Classic Who, into the domain of New Who, with the appointment of Christopher Eccleston to the role of the Ninth Doctor's incarnation. So, though his year behind the console was rife with controversy and mixed stories about what really happened to this day, we nonetheless are given a season of performance that not only brought the program back from the brink, nearly being sealed away and forgotten forever, but it was able to gain 10.8 million viewers on BBC on its opening night. So the Doctor was undoubtedly back, and the next year was going to be, go ahead, say it, Soleil.
Fantastic.
Absolutely. So, this was, as with a vast majority of our listeners, probably their lead-in to the program and to the Hooniverse as we know it, either between this introductory season in 2005 or even some folks who sort of backed into it from Torchwood.
Yeah, and I mean, we've actually got a friend that did that. They got really into Torchwood, and they're like, oh, this is actually from that Doctor Who show, and they started watching it then, and have since become a pretty serious Whovian. So it's not the first time that it's happened, and I can guarantee it won't be the last. But yeah, I mean, this is obviously the best jumping on point for New Who. You know, when you pull it up on Netflix, starts you right there with the Doctor, with the Ninth Doctor. Going forward, so a lot of people, it makes sense that's where you'd start with. And but to be fair, you know, I've seen a lot recently of like, okay, where do I start, you know, and people giving them all kinds of things, but yeah, 98% of the time this is where you're going to get it.
And just out of curiosity, clearly we know where Keir stands on this, but you guys, what was your introduction point for the Doctor?
What do you mean, which episode?
Oh, Mr. Technical. No, meaning, you know, which was your first Doctor and how did you get there?
See, this is kind of tricky for me because when I was a kid, I actually saw an episode or maybe a couple episodes of Pyramids of Mars with Tom Baker. And I was too young at the time. It didn't stick. It wasn't my, you know, cartoons after school that came on at the same time every day. It was just a random hit on PBS. And it was interesting, but I couldn't find it again consistently enough, and it just faded. And I'd forgotten about it. And then, you know, once I reach adulthood and I was listening to something and somebody was talking about Doctor Who, and I was like, well, this actually sounds like it could be kind of interesting. Let me check it out. So I started with the Ninth Doctor with, you know, Rose. So you could technically say that this is my first Doctor.
Okay, Mr. Technical. Jay, who is your Doctor?
I have to go with 10.
Okay. Haley?
A bunch of people had been talking to me about Doctor Who after the new series started back up for a few years, but it wasn't until Matt Smith was already the Doctor on TV, and I was like, well, I guess I'll go back and start watching it. So I started with Rose, with Ninth Doctor, but I would say that Tennant is my Doctor as well.
Okay. It's my story is that my entire life I have the terrible habit of rebelling against anything that's popular and
fight the for power. Whatever.
Exactly. Woo-hoo. And I put Doctor Who in that category. Like, I'm a Star Wars guy. I've always loved Star Trek. And Doctor Who just seemed like this silly little thing on the side that didn't really care for. And actually, I attribute a lot of my reason for taking it on to Keir, and just sort of seeing his love and passion for this thing. I thought, okay, Keir's a great guy. It's almost disrespectful to not at least sample it with, and then be able to, you know, actually present a cogent argument why I'll put the Doctor away and let's go talk Star Wars. It was near the end of Tennant's run when I came in, and I jumped on Netflix and other means and started with Rose as well. And you know what? I will always say, and it's become kind of a joke, but Eccleston really is my Doctor. And I'm sure we'll get into this later, sort of, you know, what he brings to the role and comparatively to the other Doctors. You know, I love Matt. Matt Smith won me over as a great Doctor. David Tennant, at first, I wasn't with him because, again, this was the new Doctor after my Doctor.
Oh, yeah, it's post-regeneration, denial.
Oh, totally. No,
I will never love this guy because he's not my Doctor. Yeah.
Exactly. But he also definitely, I can see why there's love there, but still, in just watching these few episodes, I just smiled and nodded and went, yeah, you know, he really brings it. And other people play the Doctor. For me, he was the Doctor. When he's angry, you don't feel like he's acting. Like, there is something in Christopher's background where he knows pain, he knows joy, and he puts it all out there. And there's that certain quality to this Doctor that I may have seen glimpses in the Doctors that came after him, but I would argue that there is just a rawness and a passion that he brings to the table that will always endear me to him.
Well, that's, I think a lot of that has to do with the fact that whatever we think we understand now about the clash of egos that happened on set and off location with RTD, with Eccleston himself or what have you, we've actually, I've gotten some information sort of secondhand from, we met one of the cameramen, one of the BBC cameramen who had been doing a lot of name dropping. He's living here actually in New England now, and once we found out who he was and what his backstory was and sort of fawned a little bit about some of the projects he said he had worked on for BBC Wales, worked on for LucasArts and so forth, and he was going on and on and on about all these great accomplishments. He actually had mentioned the changeover from Team RTD to Team Steemo, because I guess that's about the time that he had been working with the crew. And he indicated, at least from whatever dramatic or deep feeling insight you could get from a cameraman, one of who knows how many on their various locations, that there was a great amount of discomfort, I think was the way that he had phrased it, from Eccleston's part, because of the way that his persona, or maybe his straight-up ego, was not being tended to accurately, which made him difficult to work with as far as the crew was concerned. But they also felt the same way about Russell himself. And you can tell a lot of that from the interviews with either one of them, that they are individuals who just feel that they have, you know, that certain amount of, you know, you need to pay attention to me. And if I'm not getting sufficient attention in the room, I want out of the room. So But it was actually Eccleston himself who requested the audition. They did not go after him. He contacted Davies's people to get the audition for the part back in prior to April 2004, whenever he was given the nod for it. But he apparently was a great match for what RTD wanted for his vision of this new style doctor. You know, he said, and I'm quoting here, he wants someone who is not necessarily young, but we want to move on from that neutered, posh, public school, fancy dress, frock coat image. He needs to be immediate and tactile, someone that you stand too close to him and you're going to get burned. And I think you genuinely get that out of a lot of what Eccleston brought to the table at the times when he had to either reminisce about the Time War, which was a new concept they dropped in to try and bury the 96 movie. Mm-hmm. They didn't want any of that to be carried over. If it got referenced at any point later on, it was going to be something that was just incidental, but they wanted to establish an entire new story that paid tribute to the 40 years prior, but did not rely on it.
Right. Yeah. And I mean, that was kind of where we were when this show was coming back. You know, we had, you know, the show had ended in, what was it? 87 or 89. I forget that. Mm-hmm. You know, and then 7 years later we got the TV movie and everyone was like, oh, that was a bad idea. Let's not do that. And so then, you know, we have another 9 year stretch with absolutely nothing. So at this point, you know, fans had believed the show was dead. Nothing was going to happen. And they took it upon themselves to start cranking stuff out. I mean, that's when we got a lot of fan made, not only, you know, audio dramas or books or anything like that, but also videos. You know, fans had put together actual like episodes and movies and stuff. And we got a lot of content that way. And then, you know, in 2005, all of a sudden, it's back on the air. And, I mean, it came back in a big way, too. You had, you know, Christopher Eccleston, who is a very accomplished actor. You know, he's been all over the place. And he's always, you know, if you're not a Whovian, he's always that guy. You know, it's like, oh, yeah, it's that guy. You know?
Yeah.
And then, you know, they also decided that, okay, they need to bring the guys in. So they cast Billy Piper, who was a former pop star at this point. You know, think Britain's
And current.
Well, okay.
I mean, she was still producing pop material at the time. It just she had gone past her peak, so to speak.
So basically, think Britain's Mariah Carey. You know, it's the kind of the same feeling that we're going with there. And so, I mean, they were trying everything they could to like draw people back in, be like, hey, look at these people that you know you recognize and that have you know that have standing. You want to watch them in something, and you recognize this name from when you were growing up. So you had a lot of stuff building up and bringing people to this. And I mean, for a show to get 10.8 million people on its pilot episode, basically, that's huge, especially in England.
Right. And I think they hit just the right chemistry regarding, regarding the casting, regarding the way they decided to go about, well, maybe beyond the first episode. Rose was for people to this day that have said, you know, I wanted to find out more about this program that you were talking about. So I queued up Netflix and I found it on there and I watched the first episode and I don't really understand what it is I'm seeing. It maybe Rose was not the ideal introductory episode to the unprepared. Maybe. I don't know.
Yeah, I almost didn't watch the show because of Rose.
Yeah.
The Autons are a little campy. You know, that is a campy carryover. Mm-hmm. You know, think of all of the adversaries that they could have used to bring the show back from the vault. Maybe the Autons weren't ideal, but they must have done something right.
Yeah, I mean there was enough of the magic there that people were like, okay, that was a little bit beyond what I was expecting, but maybe the next one gets better. And it was just enough of that magic to bring you back 1 week after the other until you sat there and you realized, holy crap, I'm hooked. Mm. You know, and you got to think when RTD took this to the BBC and said, I want to bring Doctor Who back, they laughed. You know, they were like, oh, okay, yeah, here, you know, here's a, you know, a budget, you know, and go with it. And they didn't really expect it to take off. I mean, they obviously were hoping for it. They put money into it, but they weren't really banking on it being a huge success. So the budget that they got wasn't anything what they're used to now. You know, this was comparatively to what the show ended with, it was slightly more, but not much. You know, I mean, adjust for inflation. It was kind of close to what they were working with towards the end of Classic Series. So they weren't able to do anything big and huge and, you know, introduce new villain. You could put people in a suit and give them a little latex mask, and yeah, that's brilliant. That's the kind of money they had. And you kind of see that throughout the entirety of the first series, where, you know, the effects aren't quite what we were seeing at the time in 2005, but they're better than you really expected for a campy show. The production quality wasn't really where we're used to now, especially, but they couldn't quite pull it together and completely get rid of the cheese factor.
Right. But thankfully, there was a great aspect to a vast majority of the script material itself under RTD's standpoint, and also the fact that they was working with an extremely strong team. I mean, the two executive producers that oversaw that season, Julie Gardner and Mal Young, were seasoned veterans who knew how to sort of keep their finger on the pulse of what was just enough pop reference, just enough cultural tie-in to keep even a sci-fi program, maybe not relevant, but approachable. Mm-hmm. And then it was under the overseeing eye. I mean, we all kind of credit RTD as being the showrunner, but that role didn't quite exist as far as his infrastructure. He was still just credited as head writer. And so the two sort of puppeteers through all this were the controllers for BBC One, Lorraine Hegesy, and the controller of drama commissioning, Jane Tranter. So you had these two women who had originally said that they were the one who approached Davies and said, you know, we're going to give you the blank slate for this. And this is back in 2003, but we need to come up with something where you've got a pitch that you can put together that's genuinely going to appease the fans who have been in cold storage, but we need to win over an entirely new demographic.
Right.
And his pitch was actually something that, you know, if you were to hand that to a classic Whovian, they would have been as offended as they were by the U.S. Fox movie. You know, it basically it said the fiction of the Doctor has 40 years of backstory, which we're going to ignore. That was paragraph two.
Yeah,
wow. and millions of jaws just hit the floor. He said, oh, but we're going to pay attention to the good bits. He's a Time Lord. He's got a TARDIS. He has two hearts. He has a sonic screwdriver. And he's 900 years old. And contracts pending, there's an old metal enemy called the Daleks. So, yeah, you're in for a shakeup.
Yeah.
But I think with some of the episodes we chose for tonight, it not only shows how they were able to do a fair job of taking some of the construct of a classic episode in terms of bringing an enemy into it where our lead character knows more than we do and we rely on him to be our source of information. We start seeing it through his eyes, but then we also get a better understanding of the story as we see the other characters react. Some of it is tied into the old, some of it is entirely newly created, but through all of it, it all becomes part of the mythology that we, you know, that we're so immersed in. It's the first episode that we grabbed for tonight, oddly enough, happens to be Dalek, yeah. Which was what, episode five, six?
Six. Yeah.
Of what we, I guess we can call series one of the reboot.
Yeah. And I mean, this was exciting for the classic Whovians, because this was the point where things really clicked as far as the previous history and mythos went. You know, you have them stepping out of the TARDIS, and one of the first things they see is an old Cyberman head. And, you know, watching this for the first time, you've got no clue what it is. And he, you know, the Doctor's like, oh, it's an old friend. Well, enemy. And you're just kind of like, okay, that's a weird statement. But then once you get the history, it actually kind of makes sense why he said that. Mm-hmm. You know, and then, you know, then we introduce the Daleks, which, yeah, this was a great way of bringing that history current and really catching people up to date. And it's like, okay, you don't need to know everything that happened before. You know, here's the valid bits. Here's our monster. This is the first time that we actually got like a full explanation of the Time War as well. So they're really setting the stage for what has happened in between. You know, everything that has come before, and then the gap as well is covered.
Mm-hmm. By the way, and just to note, some of the things that I love of the way this episode gets right off the ground, the futuristic year of 2012, it's always great to hear about the future, yeah, when you're a couple years past it. You got to love that. And Corey Johnson as Van Staten is, you know, he's one of those, hey, it's that guy kind of actors, you know, that supporting guy, the character actor who's just your typical embodiment of the dumb, blowhard, power hungry American. Who's not really thinking all of his actions through, you know, and they establish that right from the get go. He's kind of this larger than life, you know, get me a new president kind of thing. His approval ratings down, you know, you gotta love the way that they painted this an inch thick. But I think that first assistance, you know, for those of us looking in on it now, and for classic Whovians who started hearing, you know, when they were talking about what was going on in the cage, and they're saying, well, you know, we're still working on trying to get in through the casing, and all it's doing is screaming, and you hear that noise, you know, and you hear that digitized Nicholas Briggs voice in the background just wailing, you know, some of it, you know, the penny already drops for some of the viewers, maybe, you know, a quarter of them. And then, you know, he starts referring to the Metaltron. Well, what is a Metaltron? Oh, it's a living thing within a bionic casing. Okay, another bunch of viewers suddenly click with it. You know, but it's that slow peel away that I think when you finally get that first realization moment when the doctor's staring down the eye stalk, that is just phenomenal. I just love the way Eccleston pulls off that reveal.
Yeah, on the... Yeah, the terror that he reacts with when he recognizes what it is. I mean, that nothing else could sell it nearly as well as that did. At that moment, like when he starts to panic and pounding on the door saying, let me out. I'm like, okay, this is a bad pepper shaker.
Mm-hmm. And I love, since we don't have any of this time war relevance, we don't know why it is that, all right, yes, they're arch enemies. I get that. Mm. But there's something else to it that he is bringing to the table, that the fact that we don't know that makes it that much more compelling. You know, or the fact that, I'm sorry, go ahead.
No. And I will always be embarrassed by this, but it wasn't until the 50th that I actually realized what the doctor had done. That as a first-time viewer, as a total new Whovian, I missed the genocide aspect of the Doctor. I didn't hear it. I didn't comprehend it. What I heard was that everything was in a time lock. That in my mind, all of Gallifrey and all of the Daleks were in this bubble universe, locked away to preserve everything else. It wasn't until the 50th that I remember you guys sort of responding like, no, you missed this. They made it very clear. And in watching the episode again a couple days ago, I heard it absolutely clearly. But it, as you know, we've said, there's so much information being thrown out there that this was one aspect that I will always be embarrassed. I missed the first time around.
I missed it too. As far as I knew, it was time locked, but you know, they were still fighting away their forever war off in their own little universe.
Mm-hmm. I think it's a great thing that they were able to throw these little things in. And going back and seeing them now, especially now, gives you a whole nother appreciation for some of the breadcrumbs that they've dropped. That really, at the time, they just seemed like a sort of motivating lines that they would put in for the characters to just say, "Oh, just carry a lot of pathos." You know, as if he just went through something really traumatic and it's gnawing at you. But we're not going to give that to the audience. And if that's the case, and if that's all that they were given, they really didn't understand much more of what the lines that they were delivering were, then hats off to them for really being able to sell it as well as they did through all of that. Particularly in this episode, you know, as we look at it through the filter of what we now know through the 50th and some of those others. Mm-hmm. I think it was... really well done, the fact that they kept Rose, obviously I know that was one of the vehicles that they were doing, but kept her so, not necessarily blissfully ignorant, but just a little bit more kind of open-minded to everything that was going on. She, like we, didn't really understand the whole story of what they were trying, or what he was trying to convey. Because even for those of us who had seen Classic Who up to this point, this whole idea of this time war or this destruction, near destruction of all but one of each of the remaining races was a totally new concept. So we were just as new to it as anyone else. But whatever it was, it sounded like, you know, capital letters, serious business. So, you know, it definitely sold me.
Yeah. And I mean, that's the great thing about it, too, is that it was one of those things that, you know, there were elements that everybody could be could appreciate as, you know, as a new story, and the way that they pulled it off was great. I mean, that everyone really did buy into it, and they're like, okay, it doesn't matter where you're coming into this, how much you know ahead of time, whatever. Everyone is at the same point now. Like, you know everything you need to at the end of this episode. And yeah, they had to cram a lot of information into it, and sadly, some of this stuff gets misinterpreted. But, you know, for all intents and purposes, this was a great way of leveling the playing field between classic Whovians and people that are just coming into it.
And as Stimo said, in sort of the retrospective, what this episode specifically really highlights is the contribution of Rose, where Rose is the eyes and the ears and the thinking of the audience for someone like Haley or me, where, you know, what is this weird robot thing? And why is the doctor so angry? I felt more empathetical to, you know, Rose's position of, you know, you can't kill it. Why do you have these reactions? And it forces us to understand the doctor's position. But because without that, it just makes the doctor into this, you know, maniac.
Well, I'll underscore that. I'll take you one farther, because even for those who were familiar with what the Daleks were, or the atrocities, or just the single-mindedness of everything that we had known from them, there were many aspects through this episode where you thought that, all right, this is the last one. Maybe it's different now. Maybe everything that it's been through, or maybe the realization that it no longer has any orders to follow, will change. So, you know, you kept thinking, you know, maybe this isn't going to be. And then you realize, you know, all the time when they're having that conversation within the cage, and she's getting closer and closer to it, and looking right into it as much as she possibly can. And then when she reaches forward and makes contact with it, and then realizes it's got its DNA sequence, it's beginning the regeneration, you think that manipulative little bastard just, you know, it was playing her all along. And then you realize, okay, maybe this thing isn't quite so peachy keen. Granted, we get that flip back and forth over and over and over through this episode. I think it's one of the things that makes it as great of a written story as it is, because you keep thinking you've made a little bit of progress, and you keep getting pushed back, and you make a little more progress. I think when we finally get down to the sunlight moment, I mean, that's some really, really heavy material for anyone to take in, whether they understand the whole Dalek backstory or not. You know, it's been changed. We're not dealing with a true Dalek here. Right. So this doesn't count if you want to, you know, put that little that little asterisk on the end of it. It's not real. You know, a real Dalek would have just been a right bastard and would have shot her right through the chest plate. But this is obviously, you know, we've created a special case here. There are some of the audio stories and some of the extended novels and things where they've played around with the idea of a either a scientifically or a genetically or some other modification to a Dalek, where you see them with emotions and compassion and raising their young and things, and you're like, this is the most foreign freaking thing ever, and it turns out all to be just a big sham or hallucination or a memory implant or something, and they always roll back on it. But it catches you so off guard to see one even with the slightest inkling of emotion that I can only imagine what an unprepared viewer kind of made of that whole thing. By the way, if you search around, one of the concept artists for the first three seasons for the program was an artist by the name of Matthew Savage. Real easy name to remember. And he would be the one. They didn't actually do storyboards the way, you know, we would think for a Pixar film or something like that. But they do the concept art things. You know, we see them every once in a while when they're talking about, oh, we're gonna revamp the interior of the TARDIS or something, and they release a concept artist's sketch. He had a piece out there that had to do with what was going on within the cage when they were first talking about the idea of trying to drill into the casing and get to the Dalek within. But his concept art was freaking terrifying. They had opened the casing and they had pincers pulling the Dalek out and like drawing and quartering it. It's horrifying. Good and I God. Think if they had actually stayed to that sort of thing and made it that graphic, that the empathy levels towards the creature within would have been totally shifted through the rest of the episode.
Oh yeah.
But I mean, it looks like like one of those fifth grade earthworm dissections. It was that's a technical term.
So let's take a look at what the Doctor's portrayal through this episode. I mean, we've got him, you know, fresh out of the Time War, dealing with an enemy that he thought he had murdered. You know, I mean, he's been trying to come to terms with this genocide, and then he comes face to face with the Dalek again. And, you know, now he's got that, holy crap, this thing needs to die, and it's bringing up all his old emotions and stuff. But, I mean, like, you see that, you know, as soon as he realizes what's going on, you know, he goes, he finds a gun. He's ready to blast this thing to pieces again. You know, yeah. There's no remorse. He's like, this thing needs to die. I did the right thing. I need to kill this thing again. You know, and that's something that's very foreign to the character of the Doctor up to this point.
Quite, yeah. And maybe that was something that kind of slid past newer viewers. You know, when they get that whole lock and load moment, they're like, oh, okay, well, he must be very serious about this. Well, yeah, he is, but he's also way out of character.
Yeah. So, yeah, and that's something that you don't catch before. Like, yeah, I mean, we're still learning the character of the Doctor at this point if you've come in at Rose. So this just, it's like, okay, this is a different aspect that we have not seen yet. We don't realize how out of character it is. But then, you know, there's the moment where, you know, he's going to shut the door to keep the Dalek in. He's closing the blast door, and Rose doesn't make it. And, you know, as we're aware of the Doctor, it's, you know, we think, okay, you know, save the girl. That's, you know, prime directive. Companion cannot die, you know, but he leaves Rose in there. You know, he tells her, I'm sorry, there's nothing I can do. Yeah. I mean, that is some serious stuff. Looking back on it now with all the knowledge and everything like that, you realize how out of character that is, but that also leads a lot to the weight that he feels at that moment.
I think so. I think, and a lot of it comes back to that one line that really was the stinger moment, as far as, and it hits me every time I see it, is when they're having these conversations and the two of them are squaring off verbally, either across a monitor or in person. And the Doctor's referring to him, you know, he wants to do us all a favor and follow out your one prime directive and do away with yourself, you know, and that sort of thing. And the only line he gets back in response is, you would make a great Dalek.
Yeah.
Now, ouch.
Yeah. And I mean, that really was a great moment of, like, just realizing how far he has come, what the Time War has done to him.
Well, and that's just, and now you take that much broader appreciation we have of that now, of realizing that it wasn't even the Doctor as we know it that had to carry that out. You know, it was so far beyond his capabilities or his moral construct that he had to trade himself for that one iteration to be something, someone entirely different, to do what he knew had to be done. And he also recognized the fact that he could not be the one to have done it, the one who broke the promise. Mm-hmm. So, and then coming back from that, what do you do once that's over and you're, you know, dusting your hands off? You're like, whew, that was rough. I just barely made it through that one. Oh.
Yeah.
What did I do?
It definitely gives a lot of credit to Stimo in realizing what he accomplished with that turn of creating the War Doctor. Mm. That, you know, his ability of synthesizing the entirety of the Doctor Who universe and history, and then weaving it in such a way that it makes absolute sense and takes, you know, the sixth episode of the reboot or the restart of Doctor Who, and adding layers of complexity and brilliance to it. I mean, it's really remarkable what he was able to build on, or able to create and build on what was already laid out.
That's the mark of a very meticulous writer, of a very hardcore fanatic, and also a very careful overall production team that is, to probably a greater degree than we often give them credit, they're more concerned about continuity than we want to claim that they are, even though we rail against anything that seems to slightly impinge upon that continuity. You know, we're real quick to jump ugly with him.
No, you missed it. His shirt was blue. Series over. Show over.
But yeah, and for a program that keeps saying you can't cross over your own timeline, you sure do it an awful lot. How's that paradox taste, you jerk?
Kier, you were saying in Russell's original pitch that he was basically pitching the or jettisoning the prior 40 years.
Yeah. It,
was there a certain point where he turned and said, oh, no, maybe I should build on this foundation as opposed to blowing it up?
Well, he said, you know, he laid out all the basic constructs for the mythology as he thought it would carry over. The whole idea of, okay, it's an alien, he grabs a human, they travel the universe together, space and time, they have adventures. But for everything else, I mean, he even said things like, you know, oh, at one time he might even have this robot dog. Well, you know, it's called Canine because it's a robot dog. You know, well, I'd have one if I wanted to, but let's just leave it in this kennel for now, which, okay, all right, my blood starts to boil at that point. But he said, you know, and that's enough. The important thing is, you know, this mythology is discovered as totally new by Rose, our eyes, and the rest of the series' continuity is absolutely irrelevant. His words, not mine. This is RGD talking here. He said, I don't care that in 1973 he used Gadget X to escape from Planet Y and regeneration isn't important. Let's discover it if we need to see it one day. It's vital to build a new mythology right now on screen. So that line about the whole regeneration, I think, has to do with his idea of if you actually have to do some of the elements of the past, approach it when you need to. But for right now, they had a mission to create a story using the skeletal structure, build an audience entirely anew, and if it proved beneficial at any point to grab aspects of the previous mythos, they would do so, but it wasn't something that they felt they had to do at all times. Okay, this episode has to involve at least three items from the last 40 years or something like that.
Which is probably a healthy way to step into it, but clearly, seeing as where we are now, that one of the strengths of Doctor Who is its ability not to throw away the past, but to leverage it and to build on it and make it more interesting and add different aspects to it that have never been, you know, considered or discovered, and at the end of the day, give you this ever-evolving organic universe that just sweeps us away.
Mm. He made extensive changes to what we now know, you know, had this construct that they had been working under for 26 years prior. You know, notice too that there's very few instances. In fact, I don't think, looking over the entirety of season one, all the way through Boomtown, there's not a single one where they travel off Earth. Granted, they go to the end of Earth, but they still stay within Earth.
Mm.
Because at least within that first season, R2-D kind of felt, you know, if there's these, you know, Boobala creatures that are having trouble with a Boobala monster on planet Boobala, who cares?
Yeah, there's no emotional investment in aliens that we've never met before.
Right. So in order for, in the early stages, to make sure that it's something that you're compelled to want to be involved with, let's keep it right on Earth. And hey, what the hell, let's have all of this crap happen to London. Over and over and over.
Well, and it might also have to do with that's what enticed Rose to go with him. He told her it could go through space, and she was like, eh, whatever. Oh, it also travels through time. She jumps in the box.
Right.
Valid point. All right, so let's go ahead and jump into the next episodes that we picked out. You really can't take one without the other. So we're going to talk about The Empty Child and The Doctor Dances.
Oh, and yes.
These are the steamo-pinned episodes for Series 1, and absolutely terrifying and brilliant all at the same time.
Mm-hmm. Make sure, though, I mean, we always want to put a big, you know, hearty gold star on the chest of Steamo for his writing on the two of these, but also bear in mind that that directing these, and this was the first episodes that he had directed for the show, had been James Hawes. And I think that a lot of the decisions as to the way that the episode is conveyed, even aside from the written material, just visually and in terms of the pacing and all the aspects of it that we know and love, and you can just watch these two episodes over and over and over again, is because of that head direction.
And Kier, help me out, because
yep.
I'm always the guy who doesn't. James Hawes' background, who is he? What does he bring to the table?
Well, Hawes, in terms of his direction, or in terms of what you might know from him since,
or prior. Sure. You'd also recognize him. He was also he also directed The Christmas Invasion, New Earth, and School Reunion. So he's nice. In there for a lot of what we would consider to be kind of standout episodes. You know, Christmas mm-hmm. Invasion, mm-hmm. we absolutely adore. New Earth, okay.
Yes, sir.
School Reunion, we all thought was phenomenal. So I think it's a matter of, and one of the aspects of it, and I think it's one of the reasons why he worked very well along with Moffat, was because of the fact that they were both these dyed-in-the-wool, you know, long-standing Whovians who kind of understood some of the chemistry aspects. That was that blend between the comedy and the terror, the idea of taking those quick comedic breaks and then back into, you know, run, you know, whenever you needed to. So that becomes part of what we now recognize as that kind of new Whovian chemistry that involves snappy, snarky comments while running at top speed away from blowing uppy things.
Yeah, so this was our first really dark episode that we've gotten. I mean, with End of the World, I mean, that's obviously the Earth blowing up and stuff. But, you know, again, Rose was really the only human in there. So it was kind of hard to really see that as a really dark episode. But here we've got, you know, World War II, you know, middle of the Blitz, everything is falling apart. And you've got them focusing on this group of orphans fighting to stay alive. You know, and they're being, you know, tormented and followed by a little kid in a gas mask asking for mummy.
Yeah.
I mean, this is terrifying.
Well, I know that everyone goes on about the fact that the gas mask child is a definite creepy factor and everything. I also note, especially because of the fact that we were looking at these specifically from Eccleston's performances, he is completely alight through both of these episodes. He is full tilt glowing through these things and never, you know, for what we would consider to be kind of dark or ominous episodes because of the confrontation. And this isn't necessarily a snarling fang, you know, slimy creepo, you know, or guns firing kind of monster. We're dealing with something extremely cryptic mm-hmm. through a lot of this. But the Doctor himself is just, you know, life plus one through all this. Eccleston is just a light, and he's snappy, and he's smiling, and he's sitting down with the kids as they're, you know, in the middle of the air raid, and they're all, you know, eating their stolen meal, and he pops up at the end of the table, and he's grabbing the mashed potatoes and whatnot. I mean, he's just, you know, completely en fuego through all this, and it's this interesting little juxtaposition that I love through both of these episodes.
Well, and I think that was required because the premise and the tone is so dark that you need to have something to offset that. And if you've got the Doctor really enjoying himself and really just having the time of his life, then obviously things aren't going to be that bad. Mm. So in that moment where he realizes what's going on and goes, oh no, I mean, that's a complete plummet, because at that moment you realize, okay, things are bad now. You know, if the Doctor has switched from I'm having a blast to things are messed up, you know that there's a problem.
Mm. And haven't we commented before that, you know, one of the things that we know Stimo is an expert in is finding a primal fear that we don't realize we have, weeping angels, that there's a thing that is creeping up on you, and the only thing you can stop it with is by not blinking. You have the enemy in this, the evil thing, is a child who's lost. So it gets you in that firefly, Joss Whedon sideways way of, I'm terrified because somewhere in the back of my brain, I remember that one time at the fair, at the beach, at school, whatever, when all of a sudden I reached for my mother's hand and she wasn't there. And all of a sudden, like, the goosebumps come up and you don't realize that's what he's doing, but that's what he's doing. Mm. And it makes it that much more brilliant.
I love the final moments reveal when he's having the conversation with Nancy. You know, that whole aspect of the piecing apart, the how old are you, 19, 20, 21, you know, and doing the math on it. And I know when I first saw it and that sort of walked me through it. And it, honestly, you know, if there were any indications earlier
that that was actually the case. If there was any foreshadowing, I to this day have not seen it. Please point out any scenes that were edited into the final cut that I did not see that gave some indication of what the true relationship between the two of them were.
No, I think the only thing is the constant, are you my mummy? Which, I mean, that's just not pointing in that direction in any way until you get the rest of the pieces. And there's no way to draw that conclusion unless you're, you know, Sherlock.
Right. You almost take it because of the fact that the whole thing is just so otherworldly and alien creepo that, no, it doesn't even have a full command of the language. It's just saying something to win your sympathies.
Yeah.
You know, it's just saying words. But,
But then, I mean, like you said, you've got the Doctor who's just having a blast through it, you know, with coming off with all kinds of great lines, you know, the bananas and the, you know, when he tells everyone to go to their rooms and it's like, I'm glad that worked. That would have been a rubbish last words.
Yeah. Or picking up the cat and having this conversation with this alley cat in the most, you know, 900 years. And it's the one thing that they can't seem to grasp is the whole idea of don't wander off. You know, it's just...
Has anyone seen a blonde? I mean, a specific one. I didn't just wake up with a craving.
Yeah, I mean, this was, yeah, honestly, I genuinely do wish that there would have, just as much as we all would have thought that we'd be better served by having at least another season of Eccleston at the controls, I would have loved to at least had another episode or two where Moffat was actually writing for him, because I think the two of their personas clicked very well. I think Moffat had an excellent idea of how to put a great voice behind the Ninth Doctor.
Yeah, and that's really why I was hoping that Nine was going to come back for the 50th, because I think that Moffat would have been so brilliant at writing a part for him.
Yeah.
But one thing that we did get from this was Captain Jack Harkness.
Yeah, we did.
Now we get Haley talking.
The reason we're talking about this episode instead of Father's Day is because of Captain Jack. I'll just put that out there.
Okay. Nope, that's legit.
Walk us through that, Haley.
Well, I was like, you know, what are some really good episodes from Eccleston? Jay had already picked Dalek. I was like, well, Father's Day is really good, and then there's the two-parter. Captain Jack is in the two-parter, so decision made.
Mm. He is a handsome man.
But it's also legit because of the fact that he brings out interesting aspects of the Doctor
that
other character does. You know, it's the whole, you know, what do we really feel about the time agency? It's kind of interesting to see the two of them do their little, you know, well, you've got tech, I've got tech too. A screwdriver? Really? You still looked at a screwdriver and you thought, how can I make this more sonic? Yeah, and the great exchanges between the two of them. And granted, some of that is just actor chemistry.
Yeah. You know,
the two of them can riff off each other pretty well. It's also the writing. But then again, it's also just the fact that you've put together two characters that are very similar, as Rose notices. These are essentially two people cut from very much the same cloth, as far as the way that they react and respond to things.
Is this the introduction of the time agency?
No. This is actually a classic Who model that they did bring forward. This is the first time that we get it in New Who, and really the only time. But yeah, this was set up in classic Who.
Okay. No, any time that in New Who the time agency is referenced, it's always going to be revolving either around Jack or Torchwood in general at this point. There's been no other tie-ins. There's been a lot in the extended content, but that's even then it's dodgy at best. Mm-hmm.
But I mean, I feel like Jack was crucial in this episode because, I mean, you got to think this is the first series. We're still learning about the character. And here you take someone who is very, very similar, but different enough that the disconnects between them really set their characters apart. You know, you really do see the differences in what each character is made of because of those differences. You know, we have the Doctor who we're used to, and then you bring someone in who's very similar but just a little bit off, and you realize, okay, the things that are off are the things that really make this character stand out. And it really helps us to understand who the Doctor is and how he operates instead of just, you know, the regular routine that he goes through.
And here's a curveball that just occurred to me. Why do you think they chose to make Captain Jack American? I mean, here's a British man, a Welshman. Why would they choose to make him American?
You know, that's a good question. We probably all have our own suspicions. I don't know what the official word might have been. I personally think that might have been just because of the fact that it sort of added to his smug demeanor.
or just that kind of a view of, you know, this braggadocious Yank who just doesn't really, you know, have much of a concern or connection to what they would consider authority or chain of command or anything of that sort. He goes off and does his own thing, and he just turns out to be a bit of a cad and a con man anyway. So doesn't that just suit the Americans at the end of it all?
I think that it was more just, it was an instant way of, this person is different from the Doctor. Yeah, you do see that throughout the episodes, but it's a very clear, from the very beginning, he's similar, but there is something different. You know, and it's a way of separating the two from the get-go and not letting you figure it out as time goes on. It's just, okay, yes, there's something very similar. That, or, you know, just the fact that Harkness really wowed them and they're like, okay, sure, he's an American.
Sure.
Can I throw one little mind bender in for you here since we're talking about Jack's appearance in these episodes?
Oh, boy.
Take the bomb that Jack captures before Point of Impact and has his nice little speech while he's doing the Doctor Strange Love ride, you know, down the middle. written on the side of this German bomb, Schlechter Wolf, German.
No way.
Bad wolf.
No way.
Nice. Never caught that.
Yeah. Well, you never actually see the entire thing because Jack's leg is thrown over the side of it. But if you see pictures of the prop, it says Schlechter Wolf on the side of it. Pretty cool.
Interesting. Yeah. So, I mean,
so look how early he was already dropping all that bad wolf crap on people. Damn.
I only saw, no, because I was looking on IMDb, but in Dalek, on the website you looked at, there was like something in French maybe that meant bad wolf.
Yeah, I mean, it was, they were sprinkling it throughout the entirety of the series. You just really didn't start getting beaten over the head with it until later.
Oh, and one more little interesting trivium for you. Since we were talking about, you know, the idea of trying to determine whether or not the show had really regained its legs, Empty Child aired on May 21st of 2004. Also premiering in the UK that evening was Phantom Menace. Phantom Menace had 4 million viewers through the nation. Empty Child had 7 million plus.
Yeah, that really should have been closer to like 10 for Empty Child. This is coming from a Star Wars fan. People don't know. I'm saying we definitely got the better story here.
Yeah.
As a Star Wars fan, you disavow Phantom Menace. That's all I'm saying.
Yeah, that's kind of like the fan work that came in the dark times.
Exactly.
I did note in some of the episodes, it wasn't just Dr. Dance's, but that was just one where I picked up on his whole idea of, you know, oh, bananas are good, and that kind of thing. It seemed like they were starting to play around with what could have been as easy of a catchphrase as the whole, you know, I wear a hat now, hats are cool. Yeah. I wear a bow tie now, bow ties are cool. Bananas are good.
Yeah. Good source.
Leather jackets are good. U-boat captains are good. Thought we were heading that direction.
Well, I mean, these were some of the highlights of Eccleston's run. I mean, like we mentioned before, you know, Father's Day is another good one, but that one is far more centered around Rose. You know, we do get to see how the Doctor handles things like that and, you know, his willingness to sacrifice himself regardless, but that is far more of a Rose-centric story. But these, I feel, are really crucial in understanding who the Ninth Doctor is. Like, these are the ones that really shape him as a person.
Or at least give us a good appreciation of what he has invested or infused the character with.
Mm-hmm. And when you think about it, and knowing the politics and knowing the background, just noise that goes on, this is halfway through his run. Mm-hmm. So, you know, he's at this point, he's running full cylinder. He's not worried about defining himself. He's proven himself. There might be politics in the background, but this is where he is fully invested and able to shine. And everything beyond this, well, we know where the path takes us.
Right. Yeah. So it is great to go back and revisit these. I mean, I absolutely love the Ninth Doctor. He might not be the one that I say is my Doctor, but I mean, you can't deny how amazing Eccleston was in the role and how the show wouldn't have continued on without someone of his caliber in that first series. So it is nice to always go back and remember where we've come from and see what it was that set us on this path that we're on now. And unfortunately, wish for more, as we do so often.
We do. We do. I don't, I still to this day, you know, I'd love to, and it's one of those things, like one of those nice little mysteries about the Amelia Earhart or what have you. You always want to know what were some of the, you know, the backstory conversations, what were some of the arguments, what were some of the memos sent around that led to all this. You know, there's the fact that the BBC was the one, the first one that leaked the whole information after the airing of Rose. It was only days or just a couple of weeks later that they announced that Eccleston was not going to be continuing the role, that he was only signed on for one series. Then they redacted that, saying, oh, no, that was leaked from an inaccurate source. And then it turned out to be an accurate source after all. And they just kept dancing and tiptoeing all around the whole story. And we're just, I don't think we're ever going to really know until, I don't know, maybe until after one or the other, RTD or Eccleston, are dead and their memoirs are released to the public or something. it doesn't make any sense to me why this whole thing is as cryptic as it really is.
I think that initially it was because, you know, someone said, oh, well, you know, we're going to release this press statement. And then someone realized, holy crap, wait, we're trying to restart this show and you're already telling them that the lead actor is gone. But no, bring that back. We're not saying that. Keep it quiet for as long as we possibly can. Give this show a chance to get started before people start panicking about where it's going. Yeah, and then it just became ingrained in everyone's thought process that, like, okay, we have to keep this quiet. You don't talk about this. This is a dark part of our history. We don't want to bring it up. Yeah.
And there's something deeper to it. I mean, just the evidence is right in front of us in that. So the group of people who managed Doctor Who in the Eccleston era are now gone. We know that Stimo and Eccleston sat down and actually talked through how he could contribute to the 50th. And Eccleston still said no. And there could be other variables about, but something really dirty or just disturbing went down for him to say, I loved being the Doctor. I loved this time of my career, but I'm done. Mm. It seems madcap to me that he wouldn't come in like for like a McGann day of just filming the regeneration. Like, what kind of bad blood exists that he would not contribute to that, to something that has benefited his career, that has, you know, helped shape him as an actor? Mm-hmm. It's baffling to me.
I don't know if we'll ever get even a sufficient explanation, let alone the full explanation. I think it's just one of those things that's just going to have to be chalked up to, you know, bad things happened.
Yeah.
And leave it at that.
But that's where we're at. Unfortunately, it's just the nature of the beast at this point. You just have to accept that, you know, we're not going to get anything else from McGann. We're not going to get anything more from Eccleston. We're not going to find out why he's not there anymore. It's just, unfortunately, it's part of the history of the show now. So, right.
So, but the show now, we've got things to move forward with.
Yeah. Yes. So coming up in series 8, we have new casting announcement. Frank Skinner is going to be in series 8. We know him from, the Room 101. He's a presenter on there. He cameoed in Peter Davison's 50th anniversary tribute, the Five-ish Doctors. So I'm not sure. I haven't seen any of his other work. But I know that he said before that, you know, he feels like he won the lottery being on the show. So here we've got another fan really excited to be here.
Mm-hmm. Oh, completely dyed-in-the-wool fan. He's one of these ones where with every interview I've seen, and there are a number of articles out there because he loves to talk about the fact that he's got this opportunity. He's just a little bit excited. Starts going into all the backstories of how attached he's been to the show for decades. So the idea of finally getting his shot. I think he was even trying to pursue this back in the 90s. He wanted to be involved in the Fox production and those things as well. The lottery analogy has got to be one of the most accurate ones. Imagine what would happen if you'd be excited enough to be able to say you have some sort of a walk-on or an extra role in any program. But if someone were to say, you know, by the way, you know, on your next trip to Cardiff, you're going to have an opportunity to walk past this scene, you know, and you'll actually, you know, your face will be turned towards the camera during this one moment of a Doctor Who episode. You don't get a line. You don't get anything. Your character doesn't have a name. It's individual with dog in the background. Yeah. But you know, tell me you wouldn't be telling everyone you could possibly run into on the street.
Oh, yeah. It's you hear that and you think, okay, how many of my children do you need?
Yeah. I don't need that one. It just makes too much noise anyway. Take it.
Yeah. So, but I mean, I love the fact that fans are becoming the cast of the show. Yeah. I mean, obviously we've had that with a number of them, but just more and more are creeping in there. And it's just, it makes it very exciting.
I think that's got to be somewhat of a generational thing because of the long stretch of the run. The only cases where we find anyone who says, "Well, I'm not totally familiar with the show, but I'm totally excited about it," are anyone under the age of like 20.
Yeah.
Jenna. Jenna. <Yeah. laughs> And just looking at pictures of him, sort of men of a certain age, he's definitely Capaldi-esque.
Yeah, okay. I can see some of that. Yeah.
He's sort of a mid-50s, late-50s, like, aged Brit that, you know, it, clearly they're building around our dear new Capaldi. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
We'll see. I mean, we don't really know what capacity his role is going to be. It may be something, you know, similar to, you know, talk about comedians being involved in what we had with Simon Pegg in The Long Game. You know, just from series one or that sort of thing, which even now, you know, you may look at it and say, well, the episode was a little bit crap, but it's great to go back and
Simon
see.
Pegg.
Exactly. You get to go back and you say, oh, great. You know, look who's coming out of the woodwork to be involved with the show. So we can hope.
But the big news, or at least what I feel is the big news, and I'm going to absolutely butcher her name here, Rachel Talalay. I'm not sure.
Talalay.
Whatever.
You say tomato.
She's going to direct an episode of Series 8. So we have a female director for an episode in Series 8. Or actually two episodes, I'm sorry. Yeah.
So it's been the first time since 2010 that you've had a female director on the program. So a bit of a stretch. Mm-hmm. But,
females,
you know, she's been...
can't direct.
That's that Soleil.
At Soleil on Twitter.
Or so lame, as we like to call
it. Oh, we had to get it in.
Yep.
That's what she said.
But she's been involved in a lot of programming. You know, some of the films you'd be familiar with her with, it would be like Tank Girl would probably be the most prevalent as far as what I'd recognize. Because I really didn't follow up a lot of the Freddy's Dead, you know, the last of the Freddy Krueger nightmares and stuff. But she worked on the 13 series. She actually directed also an episode of Continuum, if you remember that sci-fi series. Haven, another one that she was involved with as well. So she definitely has her her sci-fi directorial cred.
Yeah.
Even did a Supernatural episode. So there you go. And a couple of episodes of Stephen King's Dead Zone. So all good stuff under her belt, and I'm really looking forward to it. She's also extremely excited to be involved with the process. So it's great to have somebody who's eager to jump into this.
And four episodes of Ally McBeal, so I'm behind her.
There you go. Well,
phrasing.
You can't.
Phrasing.
No, that was totally intentional.
Yeah, you can't bat 1,000. So,
yeah. Hey.
But the last little bit that we got, and this is more of just a cool little extra. There's been a video released showing the process that they went through to recover the lost episodes that we got last year. The Web of Fear and what was the other one? Enemy of the World.
Enemy.
So if you can go and watch this, and it's like 2.5 minutes long. It's nothing major. It's not a full documentary. But, I mean, it shows the care that these people went through and just the painstaking lengths that you know, recovering these videos took.
Frame by frame, yeah.
Yeah. And, I mean, it's just – it's very, very interesting just to watch, you know, one, the process, but two, the love that went into it.
And I've always been fascinated with the digital restoration process, whether it's done from celluloid or done from video construct and that sort of thing, because of the nature of what has to be done, the graphic artistry that is actually involved in the process of bringing these back to a restored digital format, whether it's minor colorization or audio optimization or any of the things that they have to do to get something back into what we would consider to be more of a modern day watchable format. You know, because when we see things in their raw form at that point, you're like, oh
oh God, it you know, I'm better off just closing my eyes and listening to it because looking at it hurts. But between this and the work that they've done for the animation recreations, it's just amazing stuff. So you know, it is, yeah, it's only a couple of minutes, but it's definitely worth checking into because you just see the labor of love that these people are pouring into it. And it feeds into the Omni rumor. So how can you go wrong there?
Exactly.
What Omni rumor? What?
The Omni rumor is that there is actually a trove out there of all of the lost episodes that the BBC are holding on to release on us in some sort of massive wave of, you know, see how much we love you kind of a thing.
The 75th anniversary drop?
Yes. Yeah, something of that sort.
Well, no, there's this cloud of space debris and all the signals are going to reflect back and we're going to get all of the episodes.
North Korea has actually been sitting on a stockpile of these that only Dennis Rodman has access to.
And his earrings.
Yes. Oh, yeah. Some refer to it as the Omni rumor. Most of us refer to it as wishful thinking. But anyway, so next week we are going to be taking a look back at David Tennant and the 10th Doctor.
You might have heard of him.
What?
Yeah, little known Scottish actor. He's been in some stuff. You never, yeah. We're excited about that one.
So prepare your hair products.
Yes.
Yeah, good luck choosing a few episodes.
I'm going to do our damnedest.
Yeah.
So. Fear water her. Of Mars. Just water of Mars. I'm going to pitch that out. God.
Well, you know, we've got a while till the next season starts. We could do like a 10-part series on the 10th Doctor.
Ooh.
10.1, 10.2.
Yeah, no. Oh, but yes, definitely get us your feedback and let us know, you know, what your favorite 9th Doctor episodes are, you know, what you enjoyed about his character, and, you know, get us prepped for next week and let us know what we need to consider for the 10th Doctor.
What we can't do without.
Yeah. For the 10th Doctor. Well, you start with the Christmas invasion and you end with, well, I don't know, the end of his run gets a little bit hazy. Anyway, this has been episode 87 of Gallifrey Public Radio. Until next week, this is Jay saying, I give you air from my lungs.
Oh, I didn't even get the sound effect on that?
Aww.
And this is Kier saying, so many species, so little time.
And this is Haley saying, I think we better initiate emergency protocol 417.
With three olives, damn it.
And this is Bert saying, I just want to tell you, you were fantastic. Absolutely fantastic. And you know what? So was I.
We'll see you next week.
Bye.
See ya!
Thanks for joining us for another episode of Gallifrey Public Radio. Join us each week for new episodes. We love getting feedback from listeners, so don't hesitate to share your thoughts with us. You can email us at feedback@gallifreypublicradio.com, tell us on Twitter @GallifreyRadio, or on Facebook at facebook.com/GallifreyPublicRadio. You can also leave us a voicemail for inclusion in future shows by calling 210-802-1477. That's 210-802-1477 to leave us a voicemail. You can head to GallifreyPublicRadio.com to leave comments on each episode. There you can also keep up to date on all the latest news and gossip, as well as what's going on in the community. Also make sure to head over to GunnaGeek.com to find out lots of other high-quality, geek-centered shows. Music by Beyond the Epilogue and Retcon Addict.
Gallifrey Public Radio is copyright 2014.
No, I think I'm just going to do the regular editing. If it sounds like crap, I'm going to blame it on Soleil.
Okay. Nice.
I like this plan.
That's the real reason why we had you on this week.
As a result of driving up to Burlington, Vermont and back over the last couple of days, I have now plowed through all of the remaining, the last few of series 3 and 4 of the 8th Doctor's Adventures on Big Finish that I had not gotten a chance to listen to. Holy crap. Holy crap. Lucy Bleeding Miller is just, you know, I could shoot Rose in the head and not miss her. No, I'm sorry. Soleil.
Hey.